Good afternoon. This is Dr. Daniel J. Guerra, and this is Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today is 3 April 2024. You're listening to my Biochemical Mosaic number 3 on inflammasomes. This is going to be lecture number 11. Now, I promised you last time that I was going to do some metaphysics, and I'm going to do that, but I'm also going to spend a lot of time on epistemology. And of course, I'm going to integrate that into the discussion we're having in this biochemical mosaic. So it's not simply going to be philosophy, right? So let's think about how we want to apprehend this whole process. I think the best way to look at it, knowledge is best apprehended as a sequence of events that organize intellectually via intralocution. Now, in this sense, scientia habet rationem, for the prolegomenon of acquired reason via free choice of the will. Now, how I process the world includes, how anyone processes the world includes, the experience of events that one has studied and those you have not studied. So for all external domains with which I possess limited understanding, I'm covalently tethered to a deficiency of coherent ideology. And thus, I would say, impoverished to conceptualize or even imagine truths, either supporting or refuting those events. I conclude that my faculties of reason, while unlimited for dialectical introspection, can be unimpressive when it comes to the ontology of systems existentially unknown to me. Furthermore, when I do own extensive experience and contemplation of cohering events, the concepts and ideas surrounding them empower me to form reasoned judgments that are founded on truths I believe. So this stands as my argument for the illegitimacy of mere opinion, which only requires unfounded premises to form invalid conclusions and unsound arguments. A dialectical analysis requires veracity in the premises, based on coherence and foundation to experience and reason, plus the formulation of a valid conclusion based on those premises, thus obtaining the sound argument. While the elements of my argument are classical, I would say, Platonism with a tinge of Aristotelianism, my contribution is the primacy of belief. This is where my particular philosophy starts to integrate into this discussion more completely. Of course, my understanding of intralocution is also something that I've derivatized. You know, interlocution is communication between, say, two people. Intralocution is communication internally. And so we all do this. We might call it thinking. We might call it mentation. But those words, I think, are too vague. So I've decided intralocution is more precise. And you can decide to agree with me or no or not, right? Now, in order for me to profess knowledge of events, which I do in biochemistry, particularly on these lecture circuit for authentic biochemistry, I must believe in the truths I have uncovered, thus pointing to an endojective reality. Endojective is another term of mine, and that rather than talking about subjective, which normally sounds like a bias, endojective simply means that it's thrown within, rather than thrown without. So if you follow that terminology, an exojective would then correlate to an objective bias. So an objective, we try to argue, is, well, that's more sound. It's not about me. Subjective is about me. I argue, and I've argued this extensively in other writings and in lectures, that there is nothing that you hold to be true that you do not have to carry out an endojective movement for. Otherwise, why would you go around saying something is true, especially to yourself, or say for your immediately for your loved ones? You can't go around believing what you know is a lie. So the endojective movement, otherwise known when you're talking about just simple bias or point of view as subjective, is not wrong at all. In fact, it's likely to be far more in the realm of veracity than simply saying, well, I'm accepting what is said outside of me, that exojective movement, so-called objective. I will listen to what others have said, and then I'm just going to adopt it, you see? I think that's a very poor excuse for standing for what you say you believe in. And when you're a professor and you're lecturing biochemistry, you want to be as truthful as possible, which means you have to build it upon the literature. So there's a huge expanse of information that has to be internalized via interlocution to be able to formulate a knowledge base to be able to then profess it to others. So that's what I mean by this whole concept of endojective and the interlocutive process, right? So I have to believe the truths that I've uncovered. And so I point to that endojective reality. Now we have a choice in what we do. Most importantly, how we do it. If that premise is valid, one need only examine their present circumstance. Each person has a public persona that is established in some network, and which includes family first, and then all of the other interpersonal relations that extend beyond that genetic association. He or she also possesses a private interior, and that is our inner individual that looks back from the mirror and non-verbally answers in some, I guess you could call, occult language. So what you end up having then, right, is a constant raging of discussions and debates that you have as an interlocution about decisions and the potential for derailments of previously held truths. Now, let's get into some inflammasome discussion. This should be complete review. Remember Staph aureus, toxin-mediated necrotosis? How it modified and then short-circuited pyrotonic signaling, pharmacological inhibition of MLKL, dampening caspase 1 activation and the pyrotonic signaling in the host cells upon that staphylococcal stimulation. And all that was correlated with the observation that mice that were being studied here, lacking the NLRP6 inflammasome, exhibited both reduced pyrotonic and necrotonic signaling. Remember that? Okay, I know I went over that fast, but that followed this pathogen challenge. Now, big caveat, antagonism of necrotosis, such as the modulation of those proteins, MLKL1, RIPK1 or RIPK3, those kinases, remember? Remember, MLK1 is has all of the features of protein sequence that looks like a kinase, but it actually doesn't have the catalytic domain for phosphorylating. But that means it has a high affinity for proteins that have a similar sequence homology. So MLKL dimerizes and then interacts with those two kinases, the RIPK1 and the RIPK3, and they're called RIP, obviously, because they're like death domains, right? Because they're dealing with a pyrotonic or necrotonic event in this case. So MLK1, RIPK1, and RIPK3 clearly protect human and also murine macrophages, as well as neutrophils, from MRSA. Remember, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. So in keeping with that observation, the RIPK3 knockout mouse model displayed increased resistance during experimental S. aureus lung infection because of the presence of anti-inflammatory CD206 and CD200R alveolar macrophages. Remember, they accumulated in the lungs, and what they did, those macrophages were able to do as a functional reality, was clear the staphylococci. Right? Indeed, the blockade of the C-Jun N-terminal kinases, those are JNKs 1 and 2, which typically are known to trigger tumor necrosis factor and toll-like receptor-induced necrotonic cell death, or in fact, genetic ablation of that PPAR alpha, which is a ligand activated transcription factor and suppressor, in fact, of the NF kappa B activation, all of that rescues the mouse challenged with the staph from fatal lung disease associated with staphylococci, even under conditions that would normally mimic what would be called a bacterial superinfection. All right? So, this again is demonstrating the complexity of these biochemical processes. That's what I'm getting at here, and that's how this folds into our discussion of epistemology and metaphysics. A simple cursory outlining of inflammasomes, even if you go into any of these individual manuscripts we've been studying, and those aren't simple and they aren't cursory, but they're not dealing with all the other associations that we've put together for this mosaic. We're doing that because we have the liberty of having a lecture and as much time on our hands as we choose to donate to be able to put a mosaic together so we get a better understanding of the true biology of what we mean by an inflammasome. So that's, again, the reason I'm doing Authentic Biochemistry podcast is so that those that are listening to these lectures, maybe taking notes or at least playing back some of the material and reading the papers I put in the references, will be able to then accumulate a true knowledge base rather than some kind of snapshot photograph of some rough idea of what we're discussing in any given biomedical or straight biochemical or immunological or pathophysiological domain discussion. So a true knowledge base is why I'm fusing, giving you all that detail again about the staph and how pyrotosis and necrotosis are constantly interacting with one another, so that when you do finally assimilate this and then take it into your own mind and interlocute over it, your knowledge will actually be authentic, right? So a little bit more about the inflammasome, and then we're going to get back to metaphysics. Do you remember the inhibition of the OGG1? Remember, that is the base excision repair enzyme, right? Inhibition of that enzyme, silencing by DNA demethylation, suppressed the NLRP3 inflammasome. Okay. And therefore, the inactivation and NLRP3 inflammasomal induced inflammatory response, which in that instance was pyrotonic and involved interleukin-1 beta secretion, and that was in a bladder muscle model. See? So now I'm broadening out the mosaic. I'm adding in these different clinical features, but we're still talking about the same system under the microscope. And the general system for this mosaic is simply the inflammasome. Okay. Now notice we switch from the type 6 NLRP6 inflammasome to the NLRP3. Remember, that had to do with swapping out different subunit proteins that make that molecular platform in the cytoplasm. Remember that? Remember that NLRP itself is multiple subunits of proteins, NOD proteins, pyrin proteins, for example, and very specifically, actually, that have to come together. And remember, there are multiple isoforms of all those proteins. So that, again, adds such a wealth of complexity, such that, and this is all innate immune response at this point. When you take immunology, and say when you're a junior and at university, or maybe even a graduate course in immunology when you're in medical school, you're told that the innate immune response is nonspecific, right? It is nothing but not nonspecific, because all of the interaction with all these polypeptides, remember all the different lipid components like the sphingomyelinase, make the innate immune response associated with a toll-like receptor, which is measuring patterns, right? Patterns are pretty specific, right? It's a highly evolved, regulated system, far more complex than simply thinking of it as, well, a production of inflammation because of a subset of cytokines, which are causing vasoconstriction and suppression of blood flow and an increase of molecular oxygen. And all of this is somehow supposed to explain how the system clears an infection. And it doesn't at all. Right? It doesn't explain it at all. Yet the infection gets cleared when everything's working correctly from the innate immune response. And then, of course, handing off the information to the acquired immune response, right? Subsequent or sometimes at the same time, contemporaneously, right? Sure. T cells and B cells, for example, being involved with the association of dendritic cells firing through those synapses, those immune synapses, right? Of course. And then complement also playing a major role. And then the peptides involved and all the epigenetic profiling that can regulate all of that, right? That's quite specific, such that the Staph aureus infection is going to be different than Legionella infection. Example, you see, even though they're both bacteria, you see how that complexity comes into being anything but non-specific, right? It's very specific. Okay, so a little bit more about this. It was postulated that the necrotosis cell death that was mediated by the RIPK1, K3, MLKL pathway could function generally to limit inflammation, not just simple inflammation, but pathophysiological inflammation, such that that is the presentation when one says that patient, that individual, or you yourself are feeling really sick, right? Because that's often what we examine when we're talking about what's going on with a bacterial compromised system, right? What we're talking really about is responding to that massive inflammatory response, which can really enhance morbidity. And also, when it gets completely out of hand, like something associated with a septic response, it can kill an individual, right? Now, remember that MLKL, just to give you more detail about what we're talking about here. Because at this point, if you don't remember what we talked about, it's just like, what is that? Well, it's some protein. Dr. Guerra said it was some protein. Okay, what is it? MLKL encodes a protein that contains that protein kinase-like domain, but it's inactive because it lacks several amino acid residues in sequence for activity. Yet it plays a critical role in tumor necrosis factor-induced necrotosis, which, as you know, is simply a subset of programmed cell death. And it does so via, remember this? That is the MLKL interacting with the receptor interacting protein 3. Now, that's the RIP3, which is the key signaling molecule in necrotosis. And I told you that inhibitor studies and indeed knockdown of that gene inhibited tumor necrosis factor induced necrosis. So high levels of this protein, that's the MLKL, and RIP3 are associated with inflammatory bowel disease in children. But alternatively, spliced transcript variants have been described. And we went through that whole process that I'm not going to repeat right here. Okay. So why are we doing all this complex discussion after doing all of that for the last 10 lectures? Well, remember the successful control of the Asarius infection requires two major host responses. First, a rapid suppression of Asarius replication, and then the rapid regulation of the hyperinflammatory response, which will ensure that there is control over that response. So it may be that pyrotosis initiates removal of the staph infection, and that necrotosis serves to eliminate the cells that cause excessive inflammation. This should all be, again, reviewed for you, because this is what we talked about, right? Of course we did. So I'm not going to go through how, because we've already done it, starting with RIPK1 through RIPK3 through MLKL, forming a pore, can lead to necrotosis. But that at that same event ontology, RIPK3 can turn on the NLRP3 ASC caspase, and RIPK3, which would then turn on pyrotosis, and that RIPK3 can also directly affect apoptosis. Okay, so that those three different components, apoptosis, necrotosis, and pyrotosis, can all be realized by the association of just a handful of proteins interacting in a very specific sequence of events, therefore controlling all three types of programmed cell death. Two very highly pro-inflammatory, necrotosis and pyrotosis, one not. Apoptosis. And overall, all three of those PCDs are associated with clearing a staph infection. You see? All right. So that's how we got there. So again, when you start thinking about how we quickly go through all of this biochemistry, and I would not say that we actually go through it very quickly, what we're really doing is giving you a pure understanding, as pure as we can get, by describing, analyzing, and explaining, and then synthesizing, after all the initial analysis, doing the synthesis, what actually goes on in the system, that mosaic of events, right? So that's how I came up with this whole idea of having a dialectical event ontology in living systems, generating what I'm calling a dieventome, which is what we were talking about last time. So in this particular regard, and you can apply the dialectical event ontology to any system you're studying, but you have to have it in a trivalent sense. You have to have the genome, whatever the genome is contributing. You have to have the environment, whatever the environment is contributing, and you have to have what's called the immunoepigenome. Now, does the immune system function at all levels and biochemical processes in the living system? Yes, it does. So that right away is another theory, I guess, of mine, that the immune system is normally considered the surveillance and the protective system for infection and stress responses in humans. I don't think that's all it is. That's all we consider it when we take it as an isolated event. The immune system is really the regulatory network around all that occurs in the living system, from conception to death in the living system. So biological phenomena like inflammasome-mediated recovery of infected or damaged tissue involves an a priori synthesis of what I call this reception and signal transduction cascade network. And I've argued that this pattern of cohering events, and it's a dialectic because we take two opposing phenomena like the genome and the environment, okay, or the genome and the immunoepigenome, and we see how they interact with one another, but in the end, all three components have to work. That's how it's triune, see? But the pattern of cohering events appear at one level as a bioenergetic and temporal mass dynamic event, much like the events associated with chemical bond kinetics and dynamics, which we as humans created so that we understand fundamental processes that are chemical, right? We invented chemistry as a means to describe nature. We invented physics as a means to describe nature. We invented biochemistry as a means to describe living systems, right? That's the argument. So just like chemical bond kinetics and dynamics, which involve free energy, and that free energy is a flux, which is controlled by such things as ionic and hydrophobic and covalent iterations, all within a subcellular domain, always maintaining a discrete spatiotemporal equilibria, homeostasis, which is nevertheless far from thermodynamic equilibrium because it's living, right? So the whole process is over a dialectical interaction between environment and inheritance, eventing a trigonal planar axis ontology via a non-stochastic, stochastic is random, so non-stochastic means non-random, epigenetic retailoring in real time of a biological communication system using the immunological axis domain. So that's what I mean by a diaventome. So where are we on our time? Yep, we're going to stop there. Now, I have more to say on this. So I'm not sure if I'm going to follow this lecture with another epistemological metaphysical association with inflammasomes or not. Not quite finished with inflammasomes, but almost at that level for introducing new information at the level of, say, a clinical association. So I might just have one more lecture where I'm going to follow on with what I did today and do this philosophical association with biochemistry. All right. So I'm going to stop there. This is Wednesday afternoon, again, the 3rd of April, 2024. This is Dr. Dan Guerra at Authentic Biochemistry Podcast, wishing you a very pleasant evening, and bye for now.